Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. Recently, we talked about the divinity of Jesus in the Gospel of John, and one of the ways we dealt with that was with the famous seven I am sayings, such as, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Before Abraham was, I am. These are things that Jesus said in John's Gospel. Now, there are actually a lot more than seven I am sayings, but what about the other three Gospels? What about Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Are they very clear as well on Jesus' divinity? Well, the famous scholar, historian, and popular writer, Dr. Bart Ehrman, who of course teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, he's written a lot of books that have shaken the faith of many. Books like Forged, which kind of makes the case that you can't trust the scriptures. The scriptures have been doctored over time by scribes. Well, I've dealt with that in the past on this program. But he has another book called How Jesus Became God, The Exaltation of a Jewish Preacher from Galilee. He essentially says, Dr. Bart Ehrman, is that, you know, Jesus never believed that he was God. In fact, the early Christians didn't either. This is something that developed over time in the church. But this isn't the case. In fact, my professor, Dr. Craig Evans, banded together with some other scholars to write a book in response to Dr. Bart Ehrman, called How God Became Jesus, and that, yes, the early Christians, the early Catholics, believed that Jesus was God right from the start. And we're going to talk about that because the divinity of Christ, indeed the pre-existence of Christ, is also in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as well as John. Of course, John has that amazing prologue, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," echoing Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, that Jesus is the divine word, and in fact, all things were created through him. Well, Simon Gathracole, who's a scholar from the UK, kind of responded to this argument from Dr. Bart Ehrman that it was, in his view, Ehrman's view, somewhat like a Sound of Music type story, a transformation of an ugly duckling, if you will, that Jesus eventually became seen as God by the church. The Nicene Creed, God from God, light from light, of one substance, one essence, consubstantial with the Father, that came much later, he says. The early Christians didn't believe Jesus was God. But in fact, that is not the case. Now, all scholars have to deal with something called the tunnel period. And this is something Gathracole talks about, having tunnel vision. This is a period of about 20 years between the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ in about the year 30 AD or so. Although some might quibble about the actual date, whether it's 30 or 33 AD. But we do know that the first document that was written in the New Testament was not one of the four Gospels. It was, in fact, one of the letters of St. Paul, 1 Thessalonians, written about 50 AD or so. So Ehrman says that at some point during that 20-year tunnel period, that's when Christians started getting this idea that maybe Jesus is divine. Maybe he was adopted somehow as God's son at his baptism. And this is the heresy of adoptionism, by the way. The church doesn't teach that. The church says that Jesus was God's divine son from the very, very beginning. We're really talking here about Christology. Christology, what is the doctrine of Christ? What do you think about Jesus Christ? What does the church say about Jesus and who he is? Okay, so let's look at Jesus and the gospel of Mark, the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of Luke. Was Jesus portrayed in these Gospels as being pre-existent, as divine, as existing from all eternity? Well, Dr. Bart Ehrman says no in his book, How Jesus Became God. He says Jesus didn't even exist until he was conceived in the womb of Mary. Not the case, Bart, not the case. You've spoken way too soon. But here's what he says in his book. I'm quoting Dr. Bart Ehrman here, quote, "I should stress," He writes that these virginal conception narratives of Matthew and Luke are by no stretch of the imagination embracing the view that later became the orthodox teaching of Christianity. According to this later view, Christ was a pre-existent divine being who became incarnate, i.e. human, through the Virgin Mary, but not according to Matthew and Luke. If you read their accounts closely, you will see that they have nothing to do with the idea that Christ existed before he was conceived. In these two Gospels, Matthew and Luke, Jesus comes into existence at the moment of his conception. He did not exist before, end of quote. That is quite a claim from Dr. Bart Ehrman. But is that the case? Is that the case that Matthew and Luke, now we know in Mark's Gospel there is no narrative, there is no account of the conception of Jesus. In fact, it starts off with Jesus as an adult. Mark's Gospel starts with John the Baptist in the wilderness preparing the way. We've got to go to Matthew, who sort of tells the story from Joseph's perspective. And then Luke, of course, has the account of the Annunciation, the very famous account in Luke chapter 1. He probably, in all likelihood, interviewed Mary for his Gospel. But Simon Gathercole, a scholar from the UK, says, hang on here. Dr. Bart Ehrman is simply wrong about this. If you look at Matthew, if you look at Luke, those Gospels clearly portray Jesus as pre-existing prior to his incarnation. Let's look at a few verses where Jesus has this famous saying, and he says this quite a few times in the Gospels, I have come to do X, to do something or other. There are seven that he mentions in particular. Let's look at the first one. Jesus says, it is not the healthy who needs a doctor, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. And you can see this in Mark chapter 2, verse 17, Matthew 9, 13, and Luke chapter 5, verse 32. Here's another one. Jesus says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. This is Matthew 5, 17. It's from the Sermon on the Mount. Now here's a third statement. Jesus says, I have come to cast fire onto the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. That's Luke 12:49. Let's keep going. He says, do not think that I have come to bring peace on the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword or division. Matthew 10:34, Luke 12:51. Jesus says, for I have come to divide man against father and daughter against mother and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. That's Matthew 10:35. A couple more. He says, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark 10:45, Matthew 20, verse 28. And one more here, a seventh one. Jesus said, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. Luke 19:10. So what is this all about, the I have come sayings of Jesus? Well, here's the deal. When you look at the Old Testament, this saying is usually only on the lips of heavenly beings. Specifically in the Old Testament, there are angels talking about their missions on earth. I have come to do this. I am coming to do that. An example here is Daniel chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. Daniel 10:14, Daniel 11:2. There are actually 24 examples from the Old Testament, also Jewish tradition, that Dr. Simon Gathercole talks about where angels say, I have come in order to do X, whatever it might be, an earthly mission. Now, the prophets in the Old Testament never talk like that, but the angels do. And it's not that Jesus is an angel, not by any stretch of the imagination. Let's not get this wrong. He is God incarnate. The point is, though, that he has come from somewhere to do all of this stuff. And where did he come from? He came from heaven. He came from heaven. Now, there are heretical groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses that say that Jesus is an angel. In fact, the Jehovah's Witnesses teach that Jesus is the same person as St. Michael the Archangel. No, he's not. No, he's not. But the point of this here is that Christ was pre-existent as God before his conception in the womb of the Virgin Mary. All right, so let's look at some more things here as well. There are a number of other points in Matthew and Mark and Luke where Jesus is really adopting the privileges or exhibiting the privileges of God himself, Yahweh. Think about this. What are things that in the Old Testament God, Yahweh, says and does? Well, Jesus is doing these things. Jesus is, in fact, doing these things that only the God of Israel could do, speaking a certain way, acting a certain way. And when he does these things, people respond in either one of two ways. They either worship Jesus or they accuse him of blasphemy. So they know exactly what he's saying. The question is, do they believe it or not? Those are the two responses. Here's the probably the biggest example of them all. Jesus claims to be able to forgive sins. The classic example here is in Mark chapter 2, the account of the paralytic who was lowered through the roof by his friends, and Jesus says to him, "Take heart, son, your sins are forgiven." And of course, all the scribes are saying, "How can he talk like this? Only God can forgive sins." Yeah, that's the point here. The scribes get it. They recognize it, that only God has this prerogative, but they don't believe that Jesus can do it. So this is really, really important. They essentially think he's blaspheming. C.S. Lewis, a great convert to Christianity and amazing apologist and writer, he said, "Look, if Jesus isn't God, he's either a madman or something worse." He said this in Mere Christianity. But don't come with all this patronizing nonsense saying, "He's a good teacher, but I don't think he's God." If he's not really God, but he's telling people that he's God, he's not a good teacher. He's a very bad man, at the very, very least, if what he's teaching is not true. So there's the forgiveness of sins, of course. But here's a couple other things that you might not have thought about in terms of proof that Jesus is divine and preexistent as God. Even in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, forget about John, but what about in these synoptic gospels? And the word synoptic means seeing as if through one eye. Of course, there are a lot of similarities between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. All right, what about the fact that Jesus picks 12 apostles? That also, now you might think, that, how is that a sign of divinity? The nation of Israel, the people of God, the 12 tribes of Israel, sons of Jacob, who became known as Israel, they formed the nucleus of the new nation. God formed it in the Old Covenant time. Well, Jesus is essentially saying, I'm making a new Israel by picking 12 apostles. I'm essentially reestablishing a new people of God in the church, the ecclesia, the called out ones. And this church is made up of both Jew and Gentile, bringing the people of all the nations of the world together in one body, one universal Catholic body. That's what the word Catholic means, universal. And so he chooses 12. He also does this. He reveals the Father to whoever he wants to. This is what Jesus says in Matthew 11:27. It's also in Luke 10:22. He says, "No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." So he can form a people of God, and he can reveal God the Father to those people. Another thing that's also intriguing, and my professor Craig Evans talks about this in this book, how God became Jesus, the response to Bart Ehrman's How Jesus Became God. Dr. Evans said, it's amazing that Jesus says in the Gospels that the angels belong to him. He can command them. Matthew 13:41, Matthew 25:31 as well. He can command them at the eschatological harvest of souls at the end of time. Only God could do such a thing. At the end of Matthew's gospel, Matthew 28:19, baptize people, Jesus says, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. I mean, he's right up there on a level of divinity with the Father and with the Holy Spirit of God. This is the one true triune God of Israel. What about this? What about the way people react to him? Again, it's either worship or a charge of blasphemy. Back in Mark 2:7, why is he speaking in this way? He is blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And then, of course, Jesus before the high priest. In Mark chapter 14, the high priest says, "What further witnesses do we need? You have heard the blasphemy." What about the way Luke puts it in his gospel? What's really intriguing about this, this is a really, really good point that's made by Simon Gathercole here. When you look at the gospel of Luke, Luke knows it's totally inappropriate to worship a mere human being. Think about this. Alexander the Great, back in 327 BC, he tried to get people to worship him. He tried to get his fellow Greeks to worship him as a sort of living god. We know that the Roman emperors also considered themselves to be divine sons of God. Well, in the Acts of the Apostles, and don't forget that Luke didn't just write the Gospel of Luke, he also wrote a companion volume. It was kind of a two-volume set, the Acts of the Apostles. There's a point in the Acts of the Apostles when Cornelius, the centurion, he bows down to Peter as if to worship him. And Peter does what? He says, yeah, go ahead and worship me. No, he says, stand up. Don't do that because I too am a man, just like you. Acts 10:25. And there's a couple other places too where Paul, for example, some try to worship Paul and Silas. Not cool. This is absolute idolatry if this were to be allowed to happen. They won't let it happen because only God can be worshipped. So what's truly interesting about this is that Luke knows how out of bounds it is to attempt to worship a human, but yet he has in his gospel Jesus accepting worship from people on a regular basis. Look at Luke 24:52 as an example of that. In the Jewish world that Jesus lived in the first century, as Gathercole says, there is a strict divide between God and his creation. God is wholly other. He is separate from his creation. So think about that when you look at, say, the book of Revelation. Here's another case where there is an angel who reveals things to John. And John is just so overwhelmed, he's so dazzled by this, that he actually bows down before this angel as if to worship the angel. And the angel says, do not do that. Stand up. Only worship God. And you can see this in Revelation 19:10. You can also see it in Revelation 22, verses 8 and 9. Deum adora in Latin. Worship God. You can only worship God. In the letter to the Hebrews, it's interesting when you read Hebrews, because you read the first chapter of the letter, and there's so much talk about angels, about how Christ is greater than the angels. Why is there so much talk about the angels? Because in the early church, there were a lot of people that were tempted to worship the angels. And the writer says, you can't do that. You can only worship God. Oh, but by the way, you can worship Jesus. Why? Because Jesus is God. He's much higher than the angels. Paul as well, before he became St. Paul, Saul the Pharisee, in his writings, when you read the writings of Paul after he became an apostle, as Gathercole says, there's a rigid and inflexible boundary between God the Creator and the created cosmos. This is absolutely fundamental. When you look at Romans chapter 1, and we of course recently did the Romans series here on the Faith Explained program, Romans chapter 1 is all about how human beings have fallen into idolatry. This is what Paul says. They exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Romans 1:25. So don't forget, before Saul became Paul, he was a Pharisee. He opposed the Jesus movement. He didn't think that Jesus was the Messiah. He was in that tunnel period that scholars talk about between the death and resurrection of Jesus and the first writing of the New Testament, which, as it turns out, was written by Paul himself. So Paul didn't change his views after he became a believer in Jesus. These views that God is separate from his creation, he always held those views, and yet he knows that Jesus is God. If you read Philippians, that famous in Philippians 2, that Carmen Christi, the song of Christ, that Christ is in very nature God. So I just don't understand how Bart Ehrman can say that the New Testament says nothing about the pre-existence of Christ. It's not true. Matthew, Mark, and Luke say it. Paul says it, as well as, of course, the Gospel of John. The argument just doesn't hold water. Jesus is divine. For the Faith Explained, I'm Cale Clark. More in the next episode, but don't go away. We've got the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Okay, as we open up the Faith Explained Q&A mailbag, I want to remind you that you can send in your questions to me at this email address, faith@relevantradio.com, or you can find me on social media on the X app at Cale Clark is my handle, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. This question comes to me from Gloria, who's listening to Relevant Radio in Lebanon, Tennessee, 88.1 FM. And she asks this question. She writes, "Hi, Cale. My daughter and I converted to Catholicism 5 years ago when she was 13 years old. Now she's gone away to college, and she now attends a Baptist church on campus. When she comes home for breaks, she still comes to church with us, our Catholic church. My husband thinks that she is no longer Catholic, so she should not come. But if she does come to Mass, she should not receive the Eucharist. My question to you is, can she receive the Eucharist? She still calls herself a Christian. She is not against Catholicism, but we want to be respectful of the rules. And we do remember how in the beginning, before we converted to Catholicism, we were not allowed to partake of the Eucharist. I also worried what message it will send to her smaller siblings if she sits there when we all go up for the Eucharist and she has to stay sitting on the bench." Of course, by the bench, she means the church pew. "If she feels, it feels like we are separating her from following Jesus, his commandment, for no reason. Can you explain to me if there is a reason why she should not take the Eucharist anymore? Or is it still okay for her to partake when she comes to visit on her breaks from college?" End of quote. All right. Well, thank you, Gloria, for writing in. That's an important question. Okay, so this sometimes happens when, in fact, it often happens when students go away to university from a Catholic home. Very often, they lose their faith on campus, but sometimes they switch to a different faith. And that's exactly what has gone on here. It seems that your daughter is now attending a Baptist church, a Protestant congregation on campus. So what should you do in this situation? Well, your husband is saying that when she comes home, she should not receive the Eucharist when she attends Mass with you. And I think he is right. He is right. She should not receive the Eucharist until she has gone to confession. Because in all likelihood, what she has done, I don't know, because there are a whole lot of details here that I don't have. I'd love to ask you more about this, but it sounds like she's stopped attending Mass and has switched over. I can only assume that she's switched over to this Baptist congregation and does not attend Mass when she's not at home. Well, if she has missed a Sunday Mass, then she has essentially become guilty of a mortal sin. She's missed Mass as a Catholic. And not only that, it seems like she's, in a sense, rejected the Catholic faith by attending this Baptist. Now, she may see no functional difference between Catholicism and Protestantism. That would be an issue of catechesis and formation, for sure. But, as you said, she has nothing against Catholicism. So, it doesn't sound like she's rejected the Catholic Church. And she certainly probably hasn't formally left the Catholic Church. So, your husband is wrong in saying that she is not Catholic anymore. She is Catholic. She's just not a practicing Catholic at the moment. So we've got to get her, please God, back in the fold. So I think you need to have some conversations with her about why she's doing this. And is there something about the church that she's rejected? Maybe there isn't. Maybe she's just gotten to know some Baptist friends on campus and they've convinced her to come with them to their services on Sunday. You don't need to go to Mass. You've already been to the Baptist service, that sort of thing. And maybe, as I said earlier, maybe she just doesn't see any functional difference between the Catholic Church and these other Christian groups. But of course, is a fundamental difference. The Catholic Church was established by Christ. And it is his will that all people, not just all Christians, but all people become Catholic and come to a saving knowledge of the truth. Now, you said that you're worried, Gloria, also about what message it would send to her younger siblings if she just remains in the pew and doesn't receive the Eucharist when the rest of the family is receiving the Eucharist at Mass. I'd be more worried about what message you'd be sending if she were to go and partake in the Eucharist, because you guys know, and I don't know to what extent her siblings know, that she is not a practicing Catholic when she's away at school. Not to mention that if she were to receive, and this is a far bigger concern, if she were to receive the Eucharist In a state of mortal sin, this would be, of course, a sacrilegious communion, as St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. We can't receive the Eucharist in a mortal sin. It just piles one bad thing upon another and makes things even worse. So she's got to go to confession, confess missing Mass, confess perhaps not recognizing the uniqueness of the Catholic Church, confessing that to her friends. She should be inviting these friends to maybe a Catholic parish on campus. At any rate, it certainly seems like there's some catechesis in order there. And she shouldn't take the Eucharist, of course, for her own protection, as it were. We can't have her having sacrilegious communion. So I hope that that helps a little bit. Me not having all the information that I would like to have about this incident, but I hope that that's enough to at least get started on. And thanks for writing in, Gloria. Appreciate that. By the way, if anyone wants to look up the passage that I referenced in 1 Corinthians about partaking of the Eucharist in an unworthy manner, look up 1 Corinthians chapter 11, starting with verse 27. Paul writes, "Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of profaning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a man examine himself, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment upon himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have died. But if we judged ourselves truly, we should not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are chastened, so that we may not be condemned along with the world." So receiving the Eucharist in an unworthy manner in a state of mortal sin, not only can it be sacrilege, it can have even more serious repercussions, not just spiritual death for the Corinthians. Some of them even suffered physical death on top of this. So I'm not saying this happens in every case by any stretch of the imagination, but this is a very, very serious matter, because the Eucharist is Jesus Christ. And so I hope that helps. And if you have a question, you can write in to me as well. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com via email. Or you can find me on the X app at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Why not share the Faith Explained with a friend? Download the Relevant Radio app. There are great share tools for our shows. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you name it. And I'll catch you later today live on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And until then, and until the next episode of the Faith Explained, God bless you. Take care.